Part 4.
Chapter 94. Somewhere in northwest Libya. Mel Keating is in the rear of a dirty white van, parked somewhere in a very small village in what she's pretty sure, upon assessing her situation, is Libya. The back of her neck still aches from being struck by a dull sword blade more than a week ago. She's certain that her parents have believed her dead since then. She grieves for the pain and agony that miserable shithead Asim has inflicted on them, even more than she hurts for herself. She was ashamed to realize that she soiled herself when she thought she was about to have her head cut off. At a little muddy stream, she was able to hand wash her clothes and put them back on after they dried in the sun, laid out on a boulder. But that was just a rinse job. She feels filthy. Her hair is a mess, and her ankles and wrists ache where they're bound tight by plastic flex cuffs. But there was a bright spot earlier that day. She asked one of her captors to move her bound hands from her back to her front. The guy, she didn't know his name but called him Alpha, for he was the first person she met after they filmed that fake execution scene, knew a fair amount of English, and after she sobbed and said her wrists ached and her back was itchy, he said,
"A kiss. You give me a kiss, and I'll do that for you."
She was horrified at the prospect of kissing him on the lips. She would be tempted to bite down and tear off his lower lip, but Alpha offered a bearded cheek. She pretended that she was kissing a grungy coyote, and he cut off the flex cuffs at the rear and applied a fresh set at the front.
"Welcome to Libya,"
he said, laughing, as if he was amused to grant her this small favor. Idiot. His small favor was going to bite him on the ass. She looks around the van's interior again. Bare, rusted metal, old blankets and pillows here in the rear. Up ahead, an empty passenger seat row, and in front of that, driver and passenger seating. It's the middle of the night, and in the driver's seat is the captor she's named Beta. He's armed with an AK-47, the weapon of choice for revolutionaries and losers around the world, Dad told her years back. And Beta is definitely a loser. He's asleep. Her other captor, Alpha, was in the passenger seat until about 20 minutes ago, when a woman apparently came up and started talking to him through the open window. Mel didn't see her, but she heard her voice and saw the results. Alpha whispered to Beta, and the door opened, and Alpha was gone. Now, it is just the two of them. Although it's the middle of the night, there's a flickering streetlight out there, illuminating the van's interior. She moves around, sees that Beta is still fast asleep, snoring. Now's her chance. Mel moves around until she's in position. She's remembering back to when Dad was just thinking of running for Congress, and he had some friends over from the teams. And along with the drinking and storytelling and hell-raising in their small, flat backyard, they played some rough-and-tumble games, also known as grab-assing. One game involved trying to tie up or bind someone, and whoever broke free quickest won a case of Lone Star. Mel, a young girl at the time, hid in the backyard and watched and learned. Right now, she's on her knees, next to the metal hub over the right rear tire. She brings her bound wrists to her face, sees the lock mechanism on the right side. Mel bites the free end of the plastic flex cuffs, pulls and tugs and pulls until the flex cuffs rotate around her wrists and the lock mechanism is in the middle. Mel raises her arms high as she can, arches her back, and brings her bound wrists down hard on the metal hub. The pain rockets right up her arms and she falls back, trying to keep as quiet as possible. Ouch, damn it. She tugs the flex cuffs, still fastened. One more time. Again, the arms up, fingertips grazing the metal ceiling, and again. The pain is worse than before. She bites her lower lip. Tears come to her eyes. Why isn't it working? It should work. It has to work. Her wrists are throbbing hard with the fiery pain. Just a few yards away, Beta is deep asleep, and the music from her radio outside gets louder. In addition to the radio, Mel hears a woman and a man laughing. She thinks it's Alpha having a good time, and she remembers kissing that gristly, smelly face, feeling scared and humiliated. And she takes a deep breath, sore arms up again, and slam! Mel falls back again, breathing hard, her wrists free. She rubs at them, pulling off the broken plastic flex cuffs. Mel nearly whimpers with joy. My wrists and arms are free. Mel moves around, her bound feet in front of her, and she checks out a jagged piece of metal near the rear door. She inches forward, rubs the plastic on the metal, rubs it and pushes down and rubs it. A quiet snap. She wastes a few seconds rubbing her sore ankles. Now, there's a hot fury inside of her as she thinks of her kidnapping, Tim's murder, being manhandled, pushed around, drugged. Oh yes, that's why she fell asleep after eating that breakfast back in New Hampshire. And being slapped awake in some stone and brick building close to the ocean, which she could smell. Then, in the trunk of a car, bumpy drive, and that dull sword blade across her neck, crumpling her in pain. The AK-47 is right there. Just scramble over the row of passenger seats, grab it, make sure the safety is off, work the action, and she'll put Beta away forever. Then, out of the van, find Alpha, do the same to him. And then what? One armed teen girl? How many fighters are out there? Where is Asim and his cousin Faraj? What would they do if she were to suddenly jump out and start shooting? And how many rounds? The standard magazine for an AK-47 is 30 rounds. Are there any spare magazines up there? Shut up, she thinks, wasting time. She moves to the rear of the van, finds the latch, gives it a twist, clicking open, open. It feels cold out there. She grabs a blanket, wraps it around her shoulders and head, steps out. Damn it! The road seems to be just dirt and rocks, and she twists her right foot. A pulse of hot pain explodes in her ankle. Some damn easy escape, she thinks. Mel moves as quietly as she can, finally seeing her surroundings, some sort of small village. Groupings of one- and two-story stone buildings, dirt road and alleys, two streetlights, flickering. The van she was in, and two SUVs, maybe Suburbans, lights on in the near buildings. A dog barking somewhere. Knock on a door? Ask for help? No, not here. To knock on a door and have Asim answer it? She pulls the dirty blanket around her, starts limping away from the parked vehicles, trying to hurry along, knowing that at some point Beta is going to wake up, or Alpha is going to return, and then all hell is going to break loose. Mel tries to speed up, trips, and falls. She closes her eyes, tight, rolls to the side of the road, and starts quietly weeping. She's just got on her shorts and sweatshirt from the States, socks, and the smelly blanket around her shoulders. Dad, she thinks. Dad, please find me. Keeping her eyes closed, she stops the crying, waits. Minutes pass. Mel opens her eyes, now adjusted to the dark. Overhead is an incredible view, the desert night sky. So many constellations pop into view. Mom taught her the history of the stars and how their human ancestors had named them. And Mel looks and finds friendly old Big Dipper, Ursa Major. And she follows the two pointing stars in its bowl until she crosses the sky and locates the Little Dipper, Ursa Minor, Polaris, the North Star. Mel gets up, not looking at where she was lying, looking only to the north. To the north is the Mediterranean Sea. And along the sea are cities and villages, and there will be some people who speak English and will help her. She's sure of that. Mel starts moving again, seeing the outlines of the dirt road from the starlight, and even though her right ankle throbs and her wrists ache, she's smiling through the tears. She's free.
Chapter 95. Somewhere in northwest Libya. Asim al-Ashid is sitting comfortably on a padded couch, a glass of sweet tea in his hand, a plate of dates and grapes and small cookies on a table in front of him, and he's smiling graciously at his host for the night, Omar al-Muntasar. Omar is fat, bearded, wearing loose white cotton pants and shirt, and working a series of worry beads in his pudgy fingers. If this was any other night, Asim would gently get off this overstuffed couch, walk around to Omar's rear, grab his hair, and slit the fat man's throat. Omar is smiling. His words seem to be dipped in honey, but he is not bending.
My dear friend Asim, I apologize again, but it will be impossible for me to find lodgings for you and your friends tonight, Omar says. I will feed you and fuel your vehicles and prepare meals and drinks for wherever your journey may take you, but I cannot offer you lodgings. My apologies.
The man's receiving room is filled with rugs, tapestries, framed photos of Omar Mukhtar, Libya's most famous resistance leader and Asim's own personal hero, and of Ahmed al-Tribi, Libya's greatest footballer. Three of Omar's sons are standing against the wall, armed with pistols, staring at Asim with anger, knowing that the man's presence here is putting their father and their families in danger. Earlier, Omar excused Asim's cousin Faraj to check on how much gasoline would be needed for Asim's two Suburbans and the GMC van, and Asim knows that the ruse was used to leave him alone with this tribal leader, once an ally. Asim says, "My blessed friend Omar, again, I am honored to be under your roof and with your strong and devout sons, but I wonder, what kind of example are you providing them by refusing an old friend such simple hospitality?" A wave of the fat man's hand.
"Ah, but these are not simple times, are they? Like when you started your jihad. Then you could live and regroup here with few concerns, and your neighbors would always be willing to help. Today, the Russians, Turks, and Chinese all crawl around our lands with money and influence and weapons, and now the Americans are coming."
"The Americans are always coming," Asim says, "until they get bloodied, like in Somalia, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and then they leave." Omar's smile is still there, but seasoned with a brisk shake of the head.
"This time is different. You murdered the daughter of the former president. The Americans are a soft people indeed, but when you go against their children like this, especially one so prominent, they will not give up until you are dead."
"A risk I've always been comfortable to meet," Asim says, the anger growing harder inside of him.
"Your risk, yes, is quite admirable. But your presence here is putting my family at risk, and my people."
Omar points to the ceiling.
"At this very moment, an American drone could be circling overhead, and CIA agents could be reviewing its video footage, watching you walk inside. And then missiles will rain down on us. Many of us will die, women and children as well. But do you think the Americans would care? No, they would only care that they had killed you. My family and I would be, as they say, collateral damage."
"Omar, my friend."
"No," he says, heaving himself out of his chair. "Enough. Your vehicles have been refueled. You have been given water and food. Leave. Now."
Asim slowly stands up, gives a quick nod in Omar's direction, and says quietly, "I'm in your debt for offering me shelter, even if it was for a short time. But the Chinese, Russians, Turks, and even the Americans will someday leave, and you will remain, and so will I. And we will meet again, dear friend."
Omar says, "If you are alive at that time, I shall look forward to it."
The door outside opens and Asim passes by the angry-looking sons and approaches a concrete stairway, which empties into a modest tiled courtyard. Small electric lamps light the way outside, and Faraj is standing in the courtyard, along with the two men who were guarding the president's daughter. From the looks on all three of their faces, Asim knows what's happened.
"How?"
he asks. Faraj starts to speak and Asim changes his mind.
"No, later," he says, knowing that Omar's sons are looking at him,
and not wanting to give them any satisfaction or gossip to be taken back to their father, and thus to the tribesmen here. and to others in these mountains. It takes only a few minutes for his three-vehicle convoy to depart Omar's village, and from the lead suburban, he tells his driver, Tariq, to pull over, and then he assembles everyone in the glare from the vehicle's headlights. There is a confusing conversation lasting 2 or 3 minutes, during which the two men tasked with guarding Mel Keating blame each other for her escape. And when they pause in their weeping and pleading, Asim takes out his 9mm Beretta pistol and shoots the first one in the head. The man slumps to the ground, and his companion makes a run for it. Asim fires twice, catching him in the back, and then he goes to the figure on the ground and finishes him off with a bullet to the forehead. He takes a deep breath. The anger is still roiling within him. To his cousin Faraj, Asim says, "Take these two and drag them into the desert. Leave their bodies to the birds and the rats." Faraj barks out the order to the group of men, comes over to Asim and says, "Then Asim?" He puts the still warm pistol in his hidden waist holder. "We find Mel Keating," Asim says, "and finish it."
Chapter 96. Family Quarters. The White House. President Pamela Barnes is alone in a living room that is part of what's known as the family quarters on the second floor of the White House, a tumbler of Glenlivet and ice in her hand. She takes another sip, the biting taste refreshing, and she pushes away the temptation to knock the drink back and make herself another. Just one, she thinks. That's all she'll allow herself, despite the day she's just had. Before her is a large screen TV, muted and set to the History Channel. Tonight's documentary is about the very building she's living in and when and how it was built. Another small sip, trying to ration it out, and she thinks sourly of her long-ago predecessor, John Adams, whose words were carved into the stone mantle of a fireplace in the state dining room back in 1945. "I pray heaven to bestow the best of blessings on this house and all that shall hereafter inhabit it. May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof." She lowers her glass and whispers, "Guess you never imagined us ladies ruling here, eh, Johnny?" The door opens and her husband and chief of staff, Richard Barnes, comes in, still wearing his tuxedo, but with the tie undone and dangling down the front of his starched white dress shirt. He rubs at his face and says,
"Man, what a night. I could go for another drink."
"Take a seat, Richard," she says.
"Sure, in a sec," he says. "I got a thirst that needs to be quenched."
"Now, Richard," she snaps, and she waits. And like a chastened boy, he comes over and sits down on the couch adjacent to her comfortable chair. The History Channel keeps on broadcasting in silence. Quiet. Richard finally speaks.
"Is Matt Keating in custody?"
"In a matter of speaking," she says, staring at the television, the program now showing the interior redecorating done by Jacqueline Kennedy, the colors and the ache of the history still so strong. She adds, "He's in custody, all right. But in the custody of the New Hampshire Air National Guard, heading across the Atlantic just as he wanted." Richard shifts in his seat, anger rising to his face.
"How the hell did that happen? What Air Force officer disobeyed orders? Who let this happen?"
"You," she says. "You let it happen, Richard.
You."
He looks angry and confused.
"I'm sorry, Pamela. I don't know what you're talking about."
She reaches down and picks up her dispatch case. "Here are my daily set of papers, briefings, and analyses of various world problems. But there's not one single document in there telling me the details of a trip you took to Macau nearly 3 years ago, when I was vice president, when you had recently sold that cattle land for a casino development, and you flew off to Macau to celebrate one of your investors' birthdays. True?" He starts to rub his hands together.
"It's been a while, Pamela. 3 years."
"That's all right," she says. While you were out partying tonight, I was unexpectedly debriefed on what happened during your trip. To the Golden Palace, Macau. You had a wonderful time. But at some point, at about 2 a.m. local time, you received three visitors. Three young visitors. His face darkens even more. His chin appears to be quivering. Barnes says, "I'm sure you thought you had it covered. I'm certain you brought along a certain toy you had showed me back then. A military-grade jamming device that blocked the recording of any voices or images in a room. But the device didn't work, Richard. There's a recording of your activities that night." His hands are rubbing each other faster, almost frantically.
How does this have anything to do with Matt Keating?
"I'm disappointed. Again, with you, Richard," Barnes says. "Can't you see what's obvious? In exchange for that video not being publicly released, I had to let Matt Keating go." His once strong voice is shaky.
"Who had that video?"
"Samantha Keating," she says. "She came here about 3 hours ago, told me that she had received a thumb drive containing the video from a former grad student working in Macau who saw you, Richard. He was there at the same time, updating the hotel's security software. Samantha offered me a deal. Let her husband go, and the video never gets released." Richard says,
"But letting Matt fly out like that. You should have bluffed, Pamela. Demand more time. Ask to review the video and verify."
Barnes nearly drops her glass.
"Verify? For God's sake, Richard, do you think I wanted to see even 5 seconds of that video?"
He doesn't answer. He looks down at the room's carpeting. She sighs. "Tomorrow afternoon, you're announcing your resignation as my chief of staff for medical reasons. I, of course, will accept it with tears and sorrow, given that your health is so very important to me. We'll have a brief press availability out in the Rose Garden. You'll say some nice words. I'll say some even nicer words. It'll be a wonderful send-off, Richard. But before we do that, I want your office belongings packed and on the way out of the White House." He chokes out the words.
But I'm not sick, Pamela."
"Oh, yes. Yes, you are. Where it really counts." She rattles the ice cubes in her glass. "But you get to stay on as first gentleman. You'll smile and keep your mouth shut, and you won't talk to the press or anybody else in the government. You're going to find yourself traveling a lot in the months ahead as we plan for my re-election. But when it comes to day-to-day politics here, Richard, you're through."
"But Pamela, please."
On the TV screen is Pat Nixon. Poor old Pat Nixon, a first lady who never really seemed to thrive in this so-called people's house. "Richard, I can't have you as my chief of staff. Too much risk that you might be compromised one of these days if Chinese intelligence has the same video that Mrs. Keating has." He slowly stands up, wipes at his eyes with a rough-hewn right hand.
"Is that it, Pamela?"
Barnes takes a sip of the whiskey-flavored ice water left behind. "Almost. Tonight, you're not welcome in my bedroom."
"But where do I go?"
"There are 16 bedrooms in this house," she snaps. "Go find one."
Chapter 97. Somewhere in northwest Libya. From the lightning of the horizon, Mel Keating can see that the sun is about to rise, and the last stars above will eventually fade out. Her feet hurt. Her right ankle is throbbing something fierce, and she is desperately thirsty. She knows that the rising sun will make the day even hotter, but at least she'll be able to see. Since escaping from Asim al-Ashid's men some hours ago, how long, she has no idea. She is stuck mainly to the dirt road, thankful that it runs mostly north, according to Polaris. During rest breaks, she'd leave the road and go into the sands, where once something crawled over her legs and she shrieked loud enough to be heard for miles. And twice during the long night, she heard the sounds of a loud, speeding vehicle coming her way, the headlights illuminating far ahead. And both times, she raced into the desert and flopped down, pulling the dirty blanket over her, praying that scorpions and spiders wouldn't crawl in with her. Once a vehicle stopped nearby, close enough that she could hear distant voices and the rumble of the engine idling, and a handheld spotlight shot out, sweeping both sides of the road. Mel closed her eyes, remembering the times when she was younger and afraid of ghosts in her bedroom, and would think, if I close my eyes, I can't see them and they can't see me. If I close my eyes, I can't see them and they can't see me. She kept her eyes closed until she heard a disappointed shout. Then, the roar of the engine and the vehicle leaving. Still, she didn't move. And that was a smart thing for the vehicle. Maybe a pickup truck? Suddenly stopped. And the spotlight kept racing, as if it wanted to catch her coming out from her hiding spot. It's getting lighter. Her thirst is growing, and she chews on her tongue and inner cheeks, trying to get some moisture started. Nothing. She picks up a pebble, puts it in her mouth, starts chewing on that. A bit of saliva starts to emerge. But God, it really doesn't help. Mel knows that the traditional way to survive in the desert is to move at night, in the coolness, and hide out and conserve energy and water in the daylight. Find a shaded place. Look for a depression in the sand, where plants might be growing. Dig into the soil there. Find water. Find a piece of shiny metal. Flash an SOS to any overhead aircraft. All wonderful ideas, but only worthwhile if you're lost on your own out in the desert, she thinks. Not if brutal killers like Asim and his followers are out there, chasing you. Hiding in these sands and rocks means not moving, and she has to keep moving, has to find water, shelter, and hopefully, people. People who can help her, who speak English, and have a truck or a car or a motorcycle to put more distance between her and Asim. With the sun starting to rise, the landscape comes into clearer focus. Sand, exposed rocks, low scrub brush, dirt road that she's walking on, with occasional ruts where tires have worn through, low mountains and mesas all around her. Good places to hide. No wonder Asim brought her here. Wherever here happens to be. Getting lighter. She starts looking carefully at what's on either side of the road. Sees empty cans, some flattened cardboard boxes, and white plastic trash bags, which will probably last for another 1,000 years. There. A broken wooden box. Some nice slats. Mel kneels down, tugs out the longest slat. In a flat patch of dirt, she shoves the slat in about a half foot or so, and then sits down, looks at her feet. What a goddamn mess. No sneakers or boots since her kidnapping, leaving her with only strong hiking socks. Over the days, the socks have taken quite the beating, getting torn and worn. Her feet are blistered and cut, but there is no point in taking the socks off without water and soap to wash them and bandages to wrap around her feet. Mel retrieves two of the plastic trash bags, puts her feet in them, wraps them tight. With long threads torn off the edge of her blanket, Mel ties the bags as tight as she can. Hot, miserable, but at least her feet will have more protection. The sun is higher now. Mel goes to the slat of wood she's stuck into the dirt. A shadow extends from the wood, marking west, since the sun is in the east, meaning north is that way. Mel spots an oddly shaped piece of rock jutting out from a near peak. There, head toward that rock, and you're heading north. North, to the sea and villages and towns. Mel starts walking again, limping on her twisted ankle, blanket around her head and shoulders, and then the dirt road splits into left and right. Now what? The left is closer to north.
North it shall be. And she starts moving again, stomach grumbling, mouth oh so dry. Dad, she thinks. Oh, if he was still president, imagine what he could be doing right now. Every FBI and CIA agent in the world would be looking for her. And every drone and overhead satellite would also be hunting for her. But so what, she thinks. Asim didn't have to say anything. But Mel knows that with her fake execution, Asim wanted Dad and others to think she was dead. Dad and Mom, probably together at Lake Marie, mourning her. Hell, maybe even preparing some sort of memorial service. How creepy. A memorial service when she's still alive. She keeps on moving, hurrying as much as she can. The only sign of life she's seeing is a distant, uncaring bird or two. Sound travels far over this dry land, and when she hears the noise of the engine growing louder behind her, she gets off the dirt road, huddles behind some crumbled boulders. A cloud of dust erupts, extends maybe 100 feet or so, and then a battered small white Toyota pickup truck appears, the front holding 4 people squashed inside, and the rear overflowing with cardboard boxes and cloth bags, tied down with a series of ropes. The truck roars by, and the tailgate is down, and 2 women and 2 children are sitting there, feet dangling over the side, laughing as they try to stay in place with every bump and jostle. Mel makes a quick decision. She jumps up, hollers, waves her arms. Waves her arms, takes off the blanket, and flaps it up and down, up and down. Help! She screams. The truck keeps on moving, disappearing into a cloud of dust. The sound of the engine starts to quiet. Mel kicks at a rock, starts to dry sob, wondering what she'll do, how she can survive, how much longer she can keep on trudging along like this. She swings the blanket over her shoulders. The engine sound returns, whining, and the pickup truck comes back, in reverse. The 2 women and 2 children, clad in dust-covered tan and black robes, are looking at her with amazement. Mel thinks of the many things she's learned from Dad. 1, being, always be aware of your surroundings. Always. That's how she instantly knew back at Mount Rollins, when she was bathing in that isolated pool with Tim, that the 2 men approaching were trouble. They didn't fit. But this group? Men, women, children. A truck bed filled with packages and belongings? Mel doesn't think they're jihadists. She limps forward, her dry mouth cracked, and she loudly whispers, "Please, help. Can you help? Please." The women quickly start speaking in a language she doesn't understand, and which doesn't sound quite like Arabic, and one puts a child on her lap, and the other woman does the same, and both gesture for Mel to come forward. Mel gets in between the women, squeezing in on the metal tailgate, and the woman to her right yells something to the driver, and the Toyota spurts forward. She nearly falls out, but the strong hands of the women keep her in place, and they laugh at her. And Mel laughs right back, now not feeling any pain at all.
Chapter 98. Al-Shayab, Libya. Asim al-Ashid is sitting in the shaded section of a small courtyard in the home of a local tribal leader who is willing to have Asim and his comrades rest there during the hot desert day. Unlike the disloyal Omar al-Muntasar, Asim's vehicles are parked nearby, covered with a canvas awning, and substitute vehicles will be coming here soon from the larger village of Badr so he can continue his travels. Asim is dining on a late breakfast of coffee, 2 eggs, and sphins, when his cousin Faraj comes up, tugging a young woman by her wrist. Asim looks up, wipes his fingers on a tan cloth napkin, and says, "Well?" Faraj pushes the woman in front of him. She is wide-eyed, fearful, wearing a black robe across her body and over her head. Her feet are clad in dusty black Nike trainers. "Take the cloth off her head," Asim says. Faraj tugs off the covering and the woman cries out, and Faraj slaps her face, forces her into place. Asim stares and stares. The woman lowers her eyes. The body, the face, the bone structure. Yes, it will work. She looks to be in her late teens, and Asim says, "You've done well, cousin."
"Thank you," Faraj says.
Asim can't help but think of his wife, Layla al-Ashid, and his three girls, Amina, Zara, and Fatima. Now no doubt in paradise. And how, when they were alive, he would never allow himself to be in a room alone with another woman, no matter the age, to avoid the temptation.
Now?
He does what he must to get his revenge.
"Where did you find her?" he asks.
"At the special market south of Brac," Faraj says. "She is French, once married to an ISIS jihadist from Syria. He was killed and... here she is."
"Very good indeed," Asim says.
"And the hunt for Mel Keating?" Faraj frowns. "It's continuing. I am sure we will find her, cousin." Asim returns to his breakfast.
"So am I. But not with you standing here with this sad girl. Get back to the hunt. And I want her found by this evening."
He senses that Faraj is angry, but so what? Faraj knows his job, and more importantly, Faraj knows his place.
"Yes, Asim," he says, leaving,
pulling the teen girl along with him. And she starts quietly wailing as they head to the door, speaking in French, the tone begging and pleading. Asim shrugs, returns to his meal.
Chapter 99. On Highway 19, Libya. Jiang Lijun of the Chinese Ministry of State Security is sitting in the rear seat of a crowded Land Rover Defender, bouncing along this potholed road, heading south and to the Nafusa Mountains, trying hard to keep his tired eyes open. Two other Defenders are in front of this one, bouncing and jolting along, raising clouds of dust. A hard jolt nearly cracks his skull against the roof, and next to him, Walid Ali Osman laughs. Walid is a longtime asset of Jiang's, and Jiang has hired him, a tribal leader, and 10 tribesmen to go into the Nafusa Mountains to find Asim al-Ashid and free the president's daughter. Walid, a skinny bearded man, is wearing tan camouflage fatigues, as is Jiang, who's also wearing a bullet-resistant vest. He has a Chinese-made QSZ-92 9mm pistol holstered at his side, with 4 spare magazines. He tries not to yawn again. It's been a brutally long day, beginning back in New York City, where he didn't even have time to return home before grabbing a Turkish Airlines flight that eventually got him to Tripoli. A long day, with no end in sight. And when he got to Tripoli, his first thought was that his boss had sent him on a suicide mission, sent alone to Libya to rescue Mel Keating with no support. But Jiang had to obey the man's orders. Otherwise, he'd be led to a small steel room with a raked dirt floor in the embassy's basement, where he'd take a bullet to the back of his head. Walid laughs again at another jolt as they speed through a dull landscape of dirt, rocks, and brush, the rugged mountains and mesas coming into view. In good English, Walid says, "Seems there are many places yet for my Chinese friends to spend on your road and suspenders plan, eh?" "Belt End Road," Jiang says. "That's what it's called." The tribal leader laughs. "However you want to call it, it's just a way for a wealthy nation far away to sprinkle riches around, trying to buy influence and friendships." A slap to Jiang's knee. "How's that working for you, friend?" Jiang says, "You're here with me, aren't you?" That results in another laugh. Yes, after arriving in Tripoli, good fortune smiled upon Jiang because he was able to make contact with Walid. And now, here he is. Maybe, just maybe, this suicide mission has become something less deadly. Another hard jolt. Even with doors and windows firmly secured, dust is finding its way inside the Defender. Up ahead, the driver is murmuring and cursing while his seatmate holds on to an AK-47 with one hand and is yelling into a sat phone with the other. Jiang should be thinking and planning what will be done when Asim is located, but he's still haunted by that last conversation with his boss, Li Baodong, back in the basement of the Chinese UN mission building in New York. Jiang's father died for his country. Now Jiang is alone with these desert barbarians, bouncing and racing in this wasteland to retrieve the daughter of an American president, and he feels as though he should have screamed at his boss back there in New York. You stupid fat mushroom. If you had told me the truth about my father months ago, I would have gotten Mel Keating rescued back when she was being held in New Hampshire. Then, Asim and his cousin would be dead or in Guantanamo Bay. Mel Keating would be safely back with her parents. And Jiang wouldn't be here, in the middle of this wasteland, speeding off to a possible lonely and bloody death up in those approaching mountains. Shudder, bounce, rattle. This time his head does strike the padded roof. If he lives, this is his last field mission. No more. Even if it means returning to Beijing in disgrace, getting shuttled off to some distant office, placed in the middle of ungrateful Tibet or among the restless Uyghurs, Jiang is through. He wants to live and to be a good father to his own daughter for years and years to come. The man with the sat phone turns and rattles off a number of urgent words to Walid, who claps his hands with joy. "We have done it," he announces. "A small family compound, less than an hour away, inshallah. Rumor has spread that a teen American girl is now in one of the houses there, being taken care of. A guest." Jiang says, "Faster. We need to go faster." Walid pats the shoulder of the driver, tells him something, and then repeats a similar string of words to the armed man with the phone who's sitting up front. The two Land Rovers up ahead speed up, and this one accelerates as well. "Maybe I will survive the day after all," Jiang thinks.
Chapter 100. Abrika Family Residence, Libya. Mel Keating takes another satisfying drink of the slightly cool water from a metal cup and decides once again that it's the finest liquid she's ever swallowed. She's resting in a small room inside a cool stone and plaster house, lying on a pile of carpets and pillows, while an elder woman, perhaps the grandmother of this family, oversees two young women who are washing and now gently drying off Mel's sore and abused feet. All three are wearing loose black robes with colorful scarves around their heads, and the younger two seem to be about Mel's age. They chat and laugh in what she guesses is an Arabic dialect. The water. Never has she tasted anything so delicious, so refreshing, so filling. The water seems to gently wash away the dust and thirst and dryness that made her mouth feel as though she was chewing cotton balls. Her feet still hurt, but it's a pleasing hurt, part of being cleansed and healed. Still, as comfortable as she is, Mel is jumpy, fearful, turning at every noise or disturbance. She knows that Asim al-Ashid is out there, looking for her, and being here isn't like trying to hide in Georgetown, with all its buildings, streets, and alleys. She's on a rocky desert plain at the foot of these mountains, and she imagines there's not another collection of houses for miles around. As refreshed as she is, Mel needs to get out of here. Earlier, she had a moment of panic, as one of the young women took off Mel's glasses, making her instantly blind. But the woman came back a minute or so later, having carefully washed and dried them, and Mel was ashamed at her fear. Another woman comes in, her head covering a bright blue, and she puts a ceramic platter in Mel's lap. On it are small light brown cakes that look like the flapjacks Dad makes. And that makes her tear up, thinking of Dad. And there's honey drizzled over them. And she eats one, and then two. And after enough drinks, she says, "I'm sorry. Does anyone here speak English, please?" The woman serving the cakes smiles. "Yes, I do. Some. For 2 years, I went to university in Tripoli." "Oh my God. Thank you. Thank you so much for picking me up," Mel says. "I was so thirsty and lost." The woman steps back. "My name is Tala Abrika. What is yours?" Mel hesitates. All right, she's been rescued. But who are these people? Can they be trusted? Are they friends of Asim al-Ashid? The taste of the water is still in her no longer dry mouth. "My name is Mel," she says. "Mel Keating.
Thanks again for rescuing me. Tala smiles, nods. It is what we do. Mal nibbles on another of the delicious cakes, while the other women in the room chat amongst themselves. I've heard that the Libyan people are kind and gracious to strangers, Mal says to Tala. Tala's smile fades some. We are not Libyans. We are Amasai, what some call Berber. Mal sees something haunting in Tala's dark eyes, and senses she's made a mistake. I'm sorry, she says. I didn't mean any disrespect. Don't worry, Tala says. We Amasai, who live here in the Nafusa Mountains, we were hunted, killed, and oppressed by whatever evil men were ruling Libya, for the crime of being different. Only in the past few years have we had any semblance of peace. The other women, still laughing and chatting, leave the room. Now, Tala is alone with Mel. She stares at Mel with her sharp dark eyes. In a firm voice, Tala says, How did you come to be lost, Mel Keating? A young American like you, wearing the wrong clothes, wearing no shoes, on our land. Mel recalls the times she's heard Dad swapping stories and tall tales with his SEAL buddies about how, despite the years of training and experience, sometimes you just have to go with your gut, what it's telling you, what you're feeling. Mel goes with her gut. She trusts this woman. I was kidnapped in the United States by terrorists and brought here, she says. I escaped last night. Please, can you help me? Do you have a cell phone? Tala's face is solemn. We do, but there's no, what you say, coverage here? One needs to drive up to Miraz before it works. Please. Tala's face breaks into a smile. My cousin, Abu Sag, is coming here within an hour or two. He will take you to Miraz. There, you can make your phone call, and you will be safe, Mel Keating. Mushiat Allah, you will be safe. Mel is wearing soft black slippers that the elder woman slipped onto her bandaged feet, and she even dozes for a while. She is awoken when Tala comes back in and says, Quickly now, my cousin Abu is here. Tala helps Mel get up. Holding Tala's arm, Mel is led outside into a dusty dirt courtyard. She sees the old truck that picked her up, and now a dark gray Toyota Land Cruiser is parked nearby. A squat, young, bearded man, wearing blue jeans and a white buttoned shirt, gets out of the front seat, smiles, and gives a quick wave in her direction. The other women are standing near the entrance to the one-story home. There are three other similar homes, built in a semicircle. Goats and chickens scramble around, and on two of the homes, there are satellite dishes. Tala grasps Mel's hand, gives it a squeeze. Safe travels, Mel Keating. I hope we meet again. Mel chokes up, remembering Mom once saying, years ago, Most people are nice people, Mel. It's our curse that it's the evil ones who get so much attention. Me too, she says. Abu waves a hand. Come, let's go, miss, let's go. The inside of the Land Cruiser smells of incense and cinnamon, and beads and trinkets dangle from the rearview mirror. Abu is a wild and reckless driver, and Mel finds that the seatbelt mechanism doesn't work, so she ties the belt across her waist with a square knot, hoping for the best. The radio is loud, and Abu sings along. The road isn't much of a road, just a wide dirt lane, with lots of ruts, but Abu drives as if he could do this with his eyes closed. The sun is high up, and the sky is a deep blue. Not a cloud in sight. And Abu says, We get to Miraz. I let you use my phone, true? That's right, she says. He slightly leers.
Will you give me something in return?
Great, Mel thinks. We'll make the deal after I make the call.
Ha ha!
Abu laughs, and they keep on driving, the road wide and empty through the desert. Then Abu says,
Ah, look. Look there, up ahead.
The windshield is smeared with dirt and dust, and Mel can't see what Abu is seeing until they are almost upon it.
Three SUVs parked in a row, a huddle of men around the first one, examining a map on the hood. Abu speeds by.
Did you see that? Did you?
What? Mel asks. What's there?
A man from Japan or China standing there with the others.
Another barking laugh.
So lost, eh?
Mel says, I know the feeling. Some minutes later, Abu seems to curse in Arabic and taps the display above the steering wheel.
Ah, so damn stupid. I forgot to refuel. We are running low on petrol.
Mel puts one hand on her seatbelt and the other on the door handle. She thinks, if this clown is going to try the we're out of gas bullshit line, I'm bailing out the moment he slows down.
No worries, he says. Up there, the crossroads, the Dajut family, a service station, a little store. Mel, would you like a cold Coca-Cola? Would you?
Would she? Yes, Mel says. That would be great. He whistles, slaps her on the knee. Okay, she'll let that one go, and says,
it will be my delight. And unlike the phone call, no charge.
The road widens, and Mel sees two pickup trucks cross before them, both raising clouds of dust, and there are three one-story buildings in a row. With other trucks parked nearby, and men in long white robes or pants and shirts standing outside, talking amongst themselves. Abu pulls into a narrow alleyway and says,
just a few minutes, young lady. I will refuel, we'll get you the promised drink, and soon enough, you will be making that phone call.
A laugh, and then he gets out, shuts the door, and goes into the rear entrance of the nearest building. Another truck roars by on the main road. Mel gently rubs one sore foot against the other. Who to call? How to call? Sure, 911 won't work. But there is a phone number that Agent David Stahl had her memorize when Dad was in the White House. Use this number and we'll find you, he said. But will it work overseas? Maybe, if she can figure out how to dial international from Libya. What is the overseas code for calling the States? She doesn't know, but maybe Abu can find out. Mel unties her seatbelt and is reaching down to rub at her feet again when the driver's door opens. She looks to her left and freezes. A smiling and satisfied Faraj al-Rashid is looking in. Standing beside him, calmly sipping from a bottle of Coca-Cola, is Abu.
Do you think, young lady, Abu asks, that I will risk my family's safety for you, a foreigner?
Faraj reaches in and grabs Mel's shoulder, hard.
Come along, he says. Asim is eager to see you.
Mel slaps his face, hard, and breaks free, opening the passenger door, jumping out, nearly crying aloud from the jolt of pain in her right foot. She moves as quickly as she can up the alleyway, sees a road out there. Maybe she can wave somebody down or scream for help, or two men with pistols are blocking the end of the alley. Mel turns. Faraj and Abu are coming toward her, looking relaxed and confident. She says, but I don't want to see Asim. Faraj laughs and grabs Mel's shoulder, and as she is brought past Abu, she lashes out with a free elbow and shoves the hard glass bottle into the man's face.
Chapter 101. Aboard Granite 4, Mediterranean Sea. We're about 15 minutes outbound from the Tunisian Air Force base at Sfecristina when Claire Boone, Mel's friend and an operative for the National Security Agency, comes out of the KC-135's lavatory and walks over to me, squats. Next to me, Agent David Stahl is fast asleep, earplugs in his ears, arms folded across his chest. Matt, she says. Yes? She leans in so I can hear her better. We're going to be kind of busy once we get on the ground, she says. And I know I'd never forgive myself if I don't use this opportunity to ask about a mystery that's been bugging me for years. What did you say in the letter to President Barnes? The one you left in the Oval Office desk on inauguration day? Usually the text is always released, but not this time. Why? I feel like snapping at her. With all that's going on, you're worried about that? But I'm saved when Technical Sergeant Palmer comes through and says, "Okay, folks, we're coming in. Take your seats. Buckle up." Claire gets up and notices the look on my face and scurries over to her side of the fuselage. The aircraft banks here and there. The engine noise changes pitch, and I feel the KC-135 dip and drop altitude as we approach the landing strip. There are no windows or portholes to allow me to judge our approach, and like so many other times in my previous military career, I put my trust and faith in the air crew. The landing gear whines and clunks into place, one more shift in the approach, and the KC-135 lands smoothly, the reverse thrusters kicking into action, the jets rapidly slowing down. My small band of warriors either stir awake or come to attention as the aircraft slows, and Technical Sergeant Palmer approaches us and says, "Welcome to Tunisia, folks. If you unbuckle and bring your gear forward with me, we'll get you on the ground. There's no air stairs available, so we'll get you out through the entry chute." We follow in a single line to the crew compartment up front, and the tech sergeant gets to work, lifting up part of the flat deck and revealing a yellow metal grid, which he removes. He lowers a metal ladder and fastens it in place. Then the tech sergeant climbs down and opens a small hatch in the lower fuselage. Our pilot stands up, and Nick Zeppos goes down first, followed by Alejandro Lopez, and David passes our duffel bags to the two SEALs below. As this goes on, I move from one foot to the other, trying to bide my time, just knowing I need to get on the ground and get to work. Patience, I think. Get some patience or you'll move too quick and screw it up. I make my way to the ladder, and Captain Josephs reaches out and offers his hand, his co-pilot checking some paperwork. I give his hand a quick shake. "Good luck, sir," he says. "We'll be praying for you and your squad." "Thanks, Captain," I say. I take in the landscape of Svekostina's airbase, and there's not much to see. We're at the end of a commercial airfield that belongs to a small detachment of the Tunisian Air Force, with a handful of hangars and support buildings clustered in one corner. There are four single-engine trainer aircraft and a collection of helicopters, a mix of older Hueys and newer Blackhawks. A scattering of one-story buildings stands beyond the airfield's fences. The landscape is flat and brown, and the air is humid but not too hot. I've been in worse. Nick Zeppos is talking to a man wearing dark green fatigues, black boots, and a tan baseball cap, and they both laugh, and Nick slaps him on the shoulder. Then Nick says to me, "Temporary quarters all set up. This way." We begin quickly walking, and a fuel truck starts racing over to the KC-135. I see the flight crew of the Granite 4 clustered around the front of the plane, stretching their legs and waiting for the craft to be serviced. "Move, move," I think. Nick leads us into a small concrete and metal building that looks to be a maintenance facility, with workbenches, pallets, and tools hanging from the walls. It's hot and stuffy inside, with no air conditioning. Alejandro and David start clearing off the workbenches, and Nick says, "Hold tight, Mr. Matt. I'm going to hook up with the SEAL platoon, see if we can't have a briefing within the hour." "Sounds good, Nick," I say. I open my duffel bag, take out a bottle of lukewarm water, take a long gulp. David says, "The SEAL platoon here, what can they bring to the table?" I say, "First of all, 16 professional operators, probably two Blackhawks, and if we're lucky, they're the latest stealth version, which will mean that crossing the border unnoticed will be a hell of a lot easier. Night vision gear, small arms, sniper rifles, grenade launchers, explosives for breaching doors or barriers, and at least one corpsman. David, we can't do it without them." With workbenches cleared, David and Alejandro get to work, opening their respective duffel bags, taking out weapons and various pieces of equipment. I bring my own duffel bag over and start doing the same thing. I check my watch. 1 p.m. local time. "Claire," I say, "what time is sunset?" "Hold on, sir," she says. While the three of us are unloading our weapons, Claire has been getting her NSA-issued laptop up and running. Priorities. She says, "Local, sunset is 7:41 p.m., Matt." I start thinking it through. No way we're going on a cross-border raid during the day. And not right after sunset, either. Nope, the best time is always the same time, middle of the night. Bulk of your enemy are asleep, drugged, or drunk, and those on guard duty are usually bored or sleepy. The good news is that we have at least 4 hours, a good half day, to to prep and practice with the heavily armed SEAL platoon for tonight's action. The bad news? Lots of bad news. We still don't know where Mel is, only that she's somewhere 100 miles to the east in the Nafusa Mountains of Libya. And if she's at one location right now, where will she be 5 hours from now? So much to worry about. So much to plan. The door opens and Chief Nick Zeppos comes in, face drawn, and I know the bad news is about to get worse. "Sorry, Matt," he says, eyes haunted. "The SEALs were called out to help a French para unit to the south." We all go silent. I think of what I just said to my Secret Service agent. "David, we can't do it without them." Nick says, "They're gone and won't be back for days."
Chapter 102. Nafusa Mountains, Libya. Jiang Lijun's bones and muscles are aching from the rough drive he's put up with for the past half hour. He's in the sole Land Rover Defender that's climbing deeply up into these mountains, and he's sitting in the rear, next to Walid Ali Osman. The driver and another gunman are up front, and the two other Land Rovers are parked about a half kilometer behind. The gunmen who are in those vehicles are quickly climbing ahead to provide cover for when Jiang and Walid finally reach the cluster of buildings inhabited by Asim al-Ashid and his followers, a bit of information that one of Walid's tribesmen passed along an hour ago. The Land Rover bounces, sways, lurches. This dirt road makes the previous dirt road they were riding on seem like the G-45 highway south of Beijing. Since his briefing back in New York, Jiang has sent 3 email messages to Asim, telling him that he is en route, but none of the messages have been answered. Another hard jolt. Walid displays a handheld radio. "My men are on their way. When we get to Asim's residence, I will contact them, and the fighting will start, and we will rescue the American girl." The engine whines louder as the incline becomes more steep. The rock walls are so close that if the windows were open, Jiang could touch them. Jiang says, "You think Asim and his men are going to stand still while you talk into your radio?" Walid laughs. "I know what I'm doing. The radio will be in my pocket. When we're in position, all I do is touch the transmit button 3 times, sending out a signal. That's all it will take. And they know enough not to hurt any women they see, correct? We don't know how Mel Keating is dressed or where." The Land Rover tops a crest. A man is blocking the path, an AK-47 slung over his shoulder. He's wearing a dark green fatigue jacket, white trousers, and a black scarf around his head. The vehicle slows and stops. The man comes forward. It's Faraj al-Ashid, Asim's younger cousin. For the first time since he's landed back in this cursed country, Jiang feels a bit of optimism. Asim is a fanatic, a jihadist, one who is ice cold when making a decision and seeing it through. His cousin Faraj is more of a follower, more educated and, on some days, open to listening to reason. His presence here is a gift, and Jiang is rethinking the strategy he's developed with Walid over these past few hours. Jiang unbuckles his seatbelt. "Let me go talk to him. I might come up with a solution that doesn't involve gunfire." "If you say so." Walid sounds skeptical. "But I still expect to be paid, even if there is no fighting." Jiang says, "If I convince Faraj to release the American without fighting, I will pay you and give you and your men a bonus. Stay inside." He steps out onto the firmly packed dirt and raises both arms to Faraj as he starts walking toward him. Jiang's pistol is still with him, but it's holstered and visible. He wants to put Faraj at ease, to show that his visit here poses no threat. Faraj grins. "It's you, isn't it? Jiang Lijun. What a surprise." Asim's cousin comes towards Jiang, both arms held out, and Jiang thinks, "Oh no, not a smelly hug." But no. Faraj just grasps both of Jiang's hands, gives them a squeeze. He says, "Asim told me earlier that you were coming here, up to our little remote home. What an honor. What a delight. What brings you here, then?" Jiang forces a laugh in reply and quickly lowers his hands. Business, of course. Business I wish to talk to your cousin about. Farage steps back, smiling, shakes his head. Yes, Asim. He is always open to talk, except when he isn't. He told me he wasn't going to reply to your latest emails. He said, if that Chinaman wants to talk to me, let him come to my mountains. So here you are, in his mountains. How did you find him? My guides, Jiang says, and my own intelligence. Farage says, lucky for us, the Americans aren't as wise as you. And your business? It has to do with the president's daughter, correct? True, Jiang says. I want to offer him an agreement, an understanding, something that could possibly serve both our interests. Perhaps you could convince him to consider my offer. To free Mel Keating to me in exchange for various compensations. Farage scratches at his chin where a beard is slowly growing back in. I don't know about that, Li Jun. As I said earlier, he is always open to talk. He pauses. Except when he isn't. Farage lifts his right arm, makes a circling motion with his hand, and from the rocks above and to the left of him, there's a hard blast of an explosion, a slight whoosh, and a hard explosion behind Jiang. Jiang automatically falls to the ground, covering his head and ears as the explosion echoes and re-echoes behind him. He tries to get up, and Farage takes Jiang's pistol from his side, and then grabs his shoulder, gets him to his feet. Jiang turns his head. The Land Rover is on its back, burning brightly, black clouds of smoke rising up, the flames crackling and roaring, even the tires ablaze. Farage is next to Jiang, arm around his shoulder. In the distance are a number of rapid gunshots, and Jiang knows that Walid's fighters are being cut down, one by one. Now he is alone with Farage, save for the fighter coming down the rocks behind him, holding the spent RPG-7 rocket launcher in his hands. Jiang's chest aches, and not from landing on the ground. It might have been easier, he thinks, to have been in that destroyed vehicle. Farage gives Jiang's shoulder a squeeze. Ah, now that we've taken care of your guides, as you call them, it's time to meet up with Asim. I'm sure the two of you will have a lot to talk about. Jiang blinks at seeing the roaring flames. There's a brief scream from inside the shattered vehicle. If you're lucky, Farage adds.
Chapter 103. Nafusa Mountains, Libya. Mel Keating is on her second bout of exercise this afternoon, and while she's pleased to have been given this small indulgence, her right ankle is still hurting like hell. She drags it along the dirt as she is shadowed by two men in tan trousers, fatigue jackets, and caps, each holding an AK-47 automatic rifle. The men are young, with scraggly beards and nervous eyes. Dad would say they both had lousy trigger discipline because their fingers are inside the trigger guards, meaning a trip, stumble, or hard sneeze could loose off a shot. Mel's wrists are manacled at her side and tied to a wide leather belt, secured at the rear. No more plastic flex cuffs, and even with this additional binding, her two guards seem nervous, and for good reason. Mel is their responsibility, and she's sure that Alpha and Beta back there weren't given just an unsatisfactory performance review when she turned up missing. Probably two taps to the back of the head, she thinks, or something similar. She continues her dragging walk directly away from the one-story stone building that's her current prison. There are five other stone buildings in this little village, compound, or terrorist training camp, depending on one's point of view. All are one-story, though in various shapes and sizes. There are about a dozen or so fighters in this place, no women, and no children. At a small building next to the one where she's being kept, there's a cluster of satellite dishes and antennas, disguised by overhead netting and canvas. The same kind of camouflage is over four small Nissan pickup trucks, all black. Maybe they got a dealer discount on the color, she thinks sourly. At the end of her walk, she turns around, resumes her slow pace back to her jail. The buildings are in a flat stretch of land, with steep rocky slides behind and to the right, the narrow dirt and stone road to the left, and up ahead, a chunk of hollowed out and crumbling wall of rock, rising up to a flat mountain. Two men are stationed up there, armed and with binoculars to their faces. The air is cold, and the sky a crisp blue. There's a shout. Asim al-Rashid emerges from the largest of the stone buildings, accompanied by two of his lackeys, and there's laughter and chuckles. Mel wishes her arms were free so she could tackle her near guard, strip him of his AK-47, and cut them all down. Asim comes directly to her, still smiling, and she's chilled, remembering the reception she got hours ago when Faraj brought her up here. She thought she would be beaten, punched, or even worse, but Asim was in a good mood, smiling, and gently tapped her cheek.
"What a naughty girl you were," he said,
and she wishes now that she had had the presence of mind to bite his fingers. He speaks rapidly in Arabic to the two guards, who step back, and Asim says to Mel, "Let me walk with you back to your quarters." Mel resumes her slow pace. Some quarters, looks like it was once stables, still stinks.
"Yet we gave you the best room in there," Asim says. "For that, why aren't you grateful?"
Mel keeps her gaze straight ahead, not wanting to look at her captor. "You want my gratitude? Have a couple of your guys drive me out of here and drop me off at the American Embassy in Tripoli. I'll be so grateful I'll put you on my Christmas card list." He laughs, although she continues to ignore him by not looking at him. Asim has started to speak when the sound of a far-off explosion thuds in the distance. Mel stops, looks to the narrow road leading out from the encampment. She's not sure, but it sounded like a few rapid bursts of gunfire. Her chest gets tight, and she squeezes her handcuffed hands. Could it be? Is somebody coming for her? Now? A rescue attempt? Should she start running away from Asim? Asim says,
"Ah, there you go."
He checks his watch.
"Fairly on time."
Mel struggles to control her voice. "What's happening?"
"Oh,"
he says, lightness in his voice.
"Didn't you hear? A rescue party was on its way. My cousin and a number of my warriors dispatched it before it arrived."
Mel turns away, not wanting Asim to see the tears in her eyes, the disappointment in her face. But it's too much. It's all too much. And she sobs.
"So close."
Asim says,
"Ah, don't cry, Mel Keating. It wasn't the Americans, or the British, or the French. If you can believe it, someone from China, your powerful rival, tried to grab you from me. The strange ways of our world when a rival nation tries to save you. Now, no more tears. All right?"
They come to the guarded main door of the stone building, and he says,
"Resign yourself to your fate. You are here with me. Forever. Daddy isn't coming for you, and Mommy isn't coming for you. No one is coming for you. We believe that Allah wrote down in the Alal Hamafus all that has happened and will happen, and which will come to pass as written. That means that our respective fates and destinies have already been determined by Allah."
Mel decides to ignore that last bit of blather. She shuffles her feet in place, and Asim says,
"What is that?"
Mel says, "I may be living in a stone barn, but I didn't grow up in one. Just getting the dirt and dust off my feet." Two armed men flank the heavy wooden door, and Asim opens it, nods, and says,
"After you, Mel."
She walks into the darkness.